Hey, good to see you, Callum.
You as well, Joe.
Yeah. Happy Monday, everybody. Matt, how's it going?
It's good. I'm a little confused about time zones right now, as are you, I suppose.
I'm better than you are right now. You just got back from Spain a second ago. So
Yesterday. And but on the other hand, you had to shift 8 hours instead of six. So,
well, I'm used to it.
So yeah, anyway. What's eight, yeah. Nine, ten, whatever it is.
Doesn't matter at some point. Anyway, it's good.
So,
good
should
to see
we talk
you,
about interest rates?
This is the most exciting topic I think we've come across in ages. Yes, interest rates. Let's talk about it. But first, Gallup, I suppose, for people who don't know who you are, do you want to give a quick intro?
Sure. Hi, everyone. I'm Gallup. I'm a co-founder and CEO of Polytomic. I have been in data for about, well, a bit over a decade at this point. So, there's a lot that's seen as far as changes go, and then some things that just haven't really changed. It's been living through them.
Like what?
Well, I remember being a data team of one over 10 years ago, and things, well, let's just go with things that have changed in the meantime. The explosion in VCs jumping up to fund data this and data that has resulted in, we went through this phase where everyone needed a data team, emphasis on team, where you couldn't just be one or two people. You had to have a team, a big team, with loads of data people doing data things. Every company needed that badge. At some point, it just became such a high status role, along with a high salary that comes with it, which attracted all sorts. Of course, you had the invention of the title analytics engineer. Everyone became an analytics engineer. Even if you played with DBT for 5 minutes, you just rebadged yourself and got your salary bump, right, and got going. And well, you had companies with sort of DBT on DBT on DBT internally, Rube Goldberg machines of transformations, which again, bred the need to hire more and more people, and the teams got bigger and bigger. Well, Matt did mention interest rates, and then at some point, this all turned out to be a bit of a mirage, a bit of a party that was actually a temporary mirage in the desert that evaporated away. Interest rates went up, the VC funding stopped. And everyone looked at these teams and said, well, hang on, I'm paying 200K salaries for each person. What am I getting out of this? And you got your big contraction, if we can maybe charitably call it that. So we did have a change. It was a temporary one. Tools, of course, exploded. All sorts of companies got funded, whether you were doing something big or small, as long as you called it data or analytics or both. Post the contraction, it just got me thinking, well, what did not change? If you remember the cheesy phrase, God, I think this was from 15 years ago. Does anyone remember data is the new oil?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Never heard of that one before. No.
No, Joe, really? I'm
kidding. And the funny thing is it's so often misinterpreted. Like everyone quotes the Economist article that coined that. At least as far as I know, that was the first coinage. No one understands what they were actually saying in the article.
You know, last night, as I remember, I had this podcast. I actually Googled, what does data is the new oil mean? Because I was one of those people, 15 years, I've never actually figured out what this thing means. It turns out whoever coined it meant that data needs to be refined and processed like oil does in order to be made useful, which I suppose is a bit of a mundane statement, really. It turned out to be less of a cheesy meaning, although it is perhaps a cheesy statement. But the meaning behind the statements remains true. We still need to refine data to make it queryable and make it useful. There's still no magic wand here. It's really the same work being done over 10 years later. Data work still needs to feel business impact. No getting around that. You're getting paid a salary. You need to justify your existence. And it's still common for data teams to have, well, in some cases, have bosses who don't really care for data. And it's still on data teams to figure out where they fit. There's no default party that shows up at their door and says, here's a load of money, no matter what you do. So really, in other words, we're just sort of back to basics. In fact, it wasn't much of a change in the long term, rather than a temporary blip where sort of everyone just took a detour and had this grand party. And I think everyone's just gone back to the basics, which remained the same.
We're still solving the same problems.
Yeah.
We certainly solve a lot of the same problems. Like, I don't know whatever problems we're solving before the boom. I remember the big when I noticed data took off was the whole data science boom.
Yes.
Right. Yep. So that was like, you know, data science is the sexiest job, and everyone gets into data science. Everyone who was doing analytics becomes a data scientist. Matt Housley becomes a data scientist, even though he should have stuck with math.
Joe, you should have stuck with music, but here we are. We're stuck now.
I know. Here we are. I should have stuck with just being a DJ. It's interesting. But yeah, I saw this huge influx of people getting into data, and then, alongside that, companies with the articles like The Economist and every other company doing data. There's this big FOMO where you got to be doing data, or you're going to be irrelevant. The competition is going to eat you alive. Does this argument sound familiar, by the way?
It absolutely does, given AI, right?
Right.
And this is also something else that's happened, at least the VC perspective is, well, AI has, VCs ultimately, of course, are the masters of being the school of fish that chase after the shiny thing. And well, the shiny thing right now is indeed AI. And so everyone, data teams are, really filtering through founders, maybe data companies more to the point, right, are being asked about, hey, what's your AI strategy? I think there's some angst amongst data companies going, we are data and AI is data, therefore we need to do something. I'm not quite sure, given the focus on basics, that this is prudent in all cases. In general, right? It's still, I think your point, Joe, that we're still solving the same problems is really a salient one. And I'm not sure many people realize it enough to attack that rather than novelty, if that makes sense.
What are some of the basic problems? I have my own thoughts. I love yours. What are some of the basic
I say this, of course, as a founder of an ETL company, I don't mean to make it all sound terribly boring and so on, but it's still the case that you're a data person. You land in, at least my background's most familiar with B2B companies, right? Companies that sell to other businesses. You land in there as the first data person. It's time to purchase a data warehouse, go shopping. Do I want Snowflake? Just click a button. Don't think about it. And then I'll pay a lot later. Do I want Databricks? Do I want BigQuery, the dark horse in the race? Pick something. Set up your ETL processes, buy a dashboarding tool, start making dashboards galore, because everyone's always asking for dashboards. They'll never stop. They've been doing it 30 years ago. They'll keep doing it, I suspect, 30 years from now, asking for visualizations. And then solving the same problems. Now, this extends to personal problems. And then at some point, you, the data person, start facing the classic personal problem of, what am I doing here? I've spun up 77 dashboards. I have all my data. Now what? The angst still counts as a problem to solve in my book anyway, because it's even 10 years ago, this is something data teams would face, right? It's just a standard recipe. And I think there's just something there. Surely in 100 years, we won't go through these motions over and over again.
What's funny to me is that objectively data is easier now than it was 10 years ago.
Yes.
What do you mean by easier?
Well, so 10 years ago, what were you doing? Well, you probably were buying like a big heavy duty data where like on-prem system, like a Teradata or something like that. I think at that point we now had Redshift, right? But it was still this.
Yes,
new,
like, we definitely had Redshift. Yeah.
Cloud, which made things easier. And you had Hadoop, which was super complicated to deploy. And now it is so much easier to stand up a Snowflake account than it was to set up data at the time. But we've managed to make things very, very complicated in spite of the fact that the tools are easier to use than they were at the time. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's a rather fair point. And again, this may just be that funding explosion, right? This extremely artificial market that popped up that made things more complicated because it was free to do so. There's money, it will be spent, and people will find excuses for it to be spent. And I think it's really worth, as data people, to really focus on this. Back to basics is such a cliche, but there is something there. And again, I do mention the angst as well. I think the angst is part of it. I'd love to quantify this. I don't know, maybe you guys can run a survey and maybe make it anonymous. I think there's a lot of churn away from data people who get burnt out and just go off and become engineers or product managers or what have you. And again, Joe and Matt, maybe exercise to, well, not the reader, but the interviewer here, you know, I really am rather curious about this. The people who spin up the 77 dashboards and then get this huge wave of angst and wonder, what's my impact here? Something else that hasn't changed, I think the nose or the drive to find impact within the organization, perhaps is a muscle that still 10 years later, hasn't been worked a lot by data people.
Oh, it hasn't at all. No, it's like we have a lot of cool technologies. It mm-hmm. reminds me a lot of athletes who get a lot of cool gear, but still suck as athletes because they haven't developed. Right? It's like you think your cool shoes and you know your 5-inch shorts and everything are gonna help you run better, mm-hmm. new socks and all this stuff. But at the end of the day, if I look at your running, for example, your mechanics are all wrong. Right. And you have no cardio base. So what do you think is going to happen? I think this is, you can play as any other thing, but I think we have, as I wrote a while ago, we have a lot of fancy tools and no idea how to use them. And also you couple that with not a good sense of how to talk to the business and understand how to, quote, add value to the business. You know, it's going to manifest itself in a number of ways, but it typically means you're doing, what we call data theater. You're just doing data stuff for the sake of it. Right. Like, spinning up DBT, doing Snowflake, making a bajillion dashboards. Mm-hmm. I hear numbers that, 1,000 dashboards is great. Somebody else pushes back and says 10 dashboards. I don't really have a dog in the fight. But the data theater is it's a real thing. And I think a lot of people, especially the latest crop of people, I actually think we went backwards in terms of skills and knowledge.
Interesting. You think engineers?
I think we're actually back. I think we're behind where we were about 20 years ago. I can unequivocally say this, or I feel this way. Yeah.
It's a very, sounds believable to me in that we were maturing and then we just regressed due to what? Just the shiny things?
The shiny thing. That's my opinion. I think we substituted fancy tools with knowing how to use the tools, right? I would take somebody who knows how to think about data, knows how to see data in the right ways and knows how to add value with data, and that person's only using Excel, I would take that person mm-hmm. over somebody who can write 1,000 DBT models any day of the week, because that person understands what they're doing and what the mm-hmm. end objective is, which is to help push the business forward, right?
So, isn't it interesting how over 10 years, and yet here we are as a field, as practitioners? You look around and, well, I don't think this is a common phenomenon out there in the world.
Yeah, what's another industry that sort of has plateaued?
Or just sort of remains stagnant in its thinking.
Yeah.
To do the thinking, when it comes to doing the actual job, of course, right, and not the parties and the tools and so on.
Yeah.
It still feels like people haven't developed the muscle that fuels the instincts to find business impact, really as a topic in isolation, again, isolated from shiny things and so on. We still have this constant wave of data angst, sort of 2, 3, 4 years on the job, and you go, what's the point of my existence? Right? Now, again, it's not the case with everyone, of course. There are those out there, and bless them, who have developed this instinct and know that they need to in order to have a fulfilling job like everyone else, but it still feels like there are many who don't. And I don't know, you think it's a question of education, maybe? There's just, everyone gets into this reading, dare I say, vendor propaganda, rather than anything more neutral.
Well, in the data science bubble. Oh, go ahead, sorry.
Yeah, no, I remember that one too, right? Because we interview all these PhD dropouts who'd see the word scientist and go, well, I'm a scientist, and this is a scientist that pays a lot more. So I'm going to go there. Thanks very much.
Well, and also, I think everyone read these like case studies from Facebook or Google or something. Everyone saw PageRank and thought, I can do that. And in fact, if you went to a code school, you could do some basic, like nice examples. off of Kaggle, but actually making that work for the business, like Joe was saying, that's a harder problem. And somehow in these training programs, we didn't do a good job of saying, okay, if you're really what the company wants is maybe some basic analytics, but really good communication and really good understanding of what the business actually does and how you're going to help them in some way, whether it's directly financial or helping with operations or helping with customer service or things that the leaders actually care about.
Oh, that's overrated, Matt. Nobody. I'm just kidding. Okay. I'm joking.
Well, no one cares about business, you know, in a sane fashion. It does. Yeah, it's true. I am thinking right now as to why these materials just don't exist.
It's a good question. So I'll give you an example of how I'm trying to make the world a better place to borrow an aphorism.
It's rather honorable, of course.
Yeah. That was also a Silicon Valley meme back in the day. So for this data engineering specialization I'm making on Coursera, the first part of the course is spent actually teaching you how to think like a data engineer and how to talk to the business. So it's like you're going to interview stakeholders and understand what they want, right? And then formulate a game plan from there, right? Versus the traditional approaches is throwing you in, say, learning Spark out of the gate, right? I think it's a stupid approach if you're teaching somebody from scratch. Like you have to have the mental framework to think and behave like the person you want to be, right? I think that's a huge foundation. Versus the other part of it is a lot of these tutorials, you know, like Spark, for example, it's like you'll spin up Spark from scratch. I'm like, I would never trust a junior data engineer to do that ever, right? Like no situation am I going to say, oh, you did a Spark tutorial. Cool. Go set it up for me in production. That's a great idea.
Yeah, no infrastructure team will let a junior data person do that one either.
No, you'd be bad. Yeah. You'd be fired on the spot. Yeah. I would fire you. Not you, but maybe if you did that. Yeah, no,
maybe, possibly. If I did a bad job, certainly you should. Like, yeah.
You gotta be out of your mind. No, and juniors, so we teach people the wrong way, right? It's completely backwards. You have to have the mental framework in terms of understanding from the get-go that you're here to serve, you know, the organization that hired you, not just to build cool stuff all the time. It's fun to build cool stuff, and engineers are going to engineer. That's a temptation, though. Data engineers, analytical engineers, whatever, software engineers, you have the word engineer in your title. Mm-hmm. For God's sake, you should be engineering stuff, right? But even, yep. You know, I was at one point actually a mechanical engineering major. And that's real engineering. Not this bogus stuff we call, you know, engineering, but that's like, you know, lives are at stake if something breaks, like a bridge.
Yep.
And you have to go take the, you know, back in the day, at least, there's a series of exams you'd have to take in order to become an engineer. Right? And our professors would always emphasize, like, you know, how to think like an engineer. Like, when you're building stuff, are you going to put your life at risk for this? Would you drive a car on that bridge or, you know, or something like that?
That sort of question has nothing to do with the technical aspects of the job.
No. It doesn't. But it has everything to do with it. Mm-hmm. the end delivery is that. But I thought that was interesting. You know, our professor was always hammering that home. Like, you know, this isn't just math at the end of the day. Like, people's lives are at stake with the stuff you build if you're building something of importance like that, right? But his whole point was this doesn't exist in a vacuum. You're not just taking thermodynamics for its own sake for a class. It's like these have consequences.
Yeah, it's interesting. I guess you may be patient zero then for spreading the new message. You think about there may be perverse incentives here or disincentives, I suppose. If you're a data person with a lot of reach, well, maybe you're running a data team or you're running a data startup. Are you going to be the one spreading this message? Ignore the tools and get back to basics.
I already have been. Yeah, I
think Matt's you should certainly. Yeah.
Oh yeah. I mean, yeah.
I just wonder about blog posts.
I'm actually looking back, and I actually deleted my old blog accidentally. But in 2017, I had a whole back to basics series on data.
Oh, Joe, but that was before the drunken party. No one remembers.
It was, yeah. It was before the drunken party. Yeah, and even that.
So wait, imagine. When you say deleted, Joe, is it completely gone?
I think it's a backup somewhere, but I shut down some Amazon stuff, and it's like, oh, I don't want that blog around anymore. So I'm like, I just dropped it. So it was on light sale, but anyway.
One of the most basic engineering lessons, always backup. Always
backup. I have backups of it, yeah. I mean, I didn't want the blog anymore. So.
Yeah.
But I guess interesting that, Joe, within the midst of all this, and I realize I'm not being interviewed, but it's a question for you. Are you thinking about AI in the midst of all this, right? You are in the business of teaching, right? And thinking of a course and so on.
Oh, yeah. it's on my mind like 24/7, the impact of AI on education, everything. I think it has, you can look at it two ways. I think it either is going to be a thing that pushes us forward and simplifies a lot of workflows, or it makes us that much dumber.
Us, you mean humanity, or are we talking
engineers? Well, as a field, yeah. I think it has a potential to do both. I was thinking about it in the context of teaching how to code and teaching technical stuff, right? So, and just how the problem of teaching is almost inverted in some ways, because now you can have any answer you want through large language models or whatever, but is it the right answer? And how would you know if you're starting out, if the code that's spit out is actually the right code or not, right? And are you going to trust that in production? What really got me thinking, I was reading this paper from Microsoft on AutoDev, which is basically their agent workflow. It sounds like they'll probably be releasing it at some point, but it's basically an automated software engineer.
Anything interesting there?
I think there's a lot of interesting stuff there. The code was accurate to like 91% or something like that. So it would write tests and stuff, and it was, I'd give it a framework and say, I need you to fill in the test for this function and describe in doc strings and stuff, and it did a fantastic job, actually.
So it's 91% better or worse than a human? I mean,
well, it's just 91% accurate on the test, but I think, yeah, I didn't know the human comparisons, but it's pretty good.
I think the premise was that maybe 91% as good as a human, where a human fills out that 9% gap. I do wonder whether for data, anyways, since we are dealing in the business of queries, and well, some dashboards do end up being relied upon, where the sensitivity towards the error rate there is that much higher. Right? Because it's ultimately business data and ostensibly data people are making decisions over or harassing teammates over, as the case may be. I do wonder that, even if the error rate goes down to 5%, 4%, 3%, does that still mean you need to do SQL because you need to keep auditing these things?
That's a good question.
Maybe data teams devolve, maybe, right, into having someone who knows SQL and does this, sort of your grumpy sysadmin type archetype, and everyone else just doesn't need to know much. I don't know.
You could look at it from two angles, I guess. One that might be good in the sense where people are just focused now on solving problems. But yeah, I don't know. It's sort of like knowing how to fix a car, I guess, like might be a good skill. This morning, for example, right, I actually was doing plumbing at my house. I had a clogged drain and I had to snake it, and I knew what to do. I could call a plumber to do that. There's sadly no AI plumbers that can come help me at this point.
Someday.
Yeah. So it's a good question. I don't know. Some things I think you just need to know what to do. I don't know. What do you think, Matt? I mean, I think this is the thing I've been pondering a lot, is like, what happens to the nature of software and data teams is you have more agent-based workflows that are going to be propagating. And I think this is not if, but when this starts happening.
I think there's an opportunity to really rethink how we handle computer science education. The funny thing is, I think this debate has been raging for probably 20 years, well before AI existed, right? Like, what are the fundamentals that you teach people who are going to become software engineers? So for a long time, it's like, oh, you need to understand really foundational theory and go use Lisp, even though you'll never use it.
Oh, I remember that.
Yeah, exactly. Like, so many people have gone through this. And the question is that foundation going to be useful when you transition into using Java or Python or Rust or whatever language you're going to be using in production down the road? And I think as we rely more and more on automation, that there is this question like, okay, how do we teach people maybe in almost a clean room environment to work without these tools so that they'll have clearer ideas and understanding when it's time to rely on the tools in the future?
Now, we just spoke about how data people still, many of them don't have the instinct to suss out business impact. Now, do you think there'll be benefit there from AI, right? AI will make the technical aspects easier, but we're still stuck with this other issue that may breed even more useless work, dare I say.
Yeah, I mean, Cory Doctorow has this term called enshittification, where he describes basically just the degradation of the internet and the content in it. I think you could almost say the same thing has been happening. Enshittification of data teams has been happening for a long time. In the zero interest rate bubble that we're talking about. Yeah. So the knowledge part is something that I think was just glossed over. It's like, well, just learn the tool, but don't learn the underlying ideas of why you're doing what you're doing. Don't bother learning, you know, even the history of ETL and like why it came about. Mm. Why do you do this in the first place? Right? Data warehousing, for example. Why was a data warehouse invented?
Mm.
What are the big ideas in data warehousing? All these things, yeah. The context isn't there, right? So it's like, oh, just go learn, Snowflake, and you know, nothing wrong with Snowflake or dbt. Mm-hmm. I think they're all great tools, and Polytomic's cool too, and a bunch of other good tools. But it's like they're just tools. You know, if you don't know how to use them, then it's like you don't know how to use them. So
I remember, yeah, on that point, I remember Matt, you mentioned Hadoop. I remember at the height of the Hadoop craze. Oh goodness, I'm really dating myself, but at the height of the Hadoop craze, Microsoft Research put out a paper that concluded that over 87%, oh God, maybe it was even higher than that, certainly at least over 87% of Hadoop users were needlessly using Hadoop. Their data actually fit on one machine, and that was okay. But here they were, right? And this is a rather large number. And one wonders, again, whether the same thing applies to data. There's just so much embrace of things that are marketed and hyped when really, you know, maybe two spreadsheets will do.
Whereas
if you just take your nose for business impact and just focus on that, you may end up with a situation where you don't need as much at all.
It's super true. Yeah, it's Excel's even, you know, I think a lot of people are going back to that too, anecdotally. Like, there's nothing wrong.
Oh, really? Oh, yeah. If it solves a problem, right? Who cares?
Exactly.
You know, if you need some CSV update once a month, do you need to go buy 7 fancy tools?
Yes, you have to. There's a good question I probably want to get to it before I forget. Russ asks, with all the FOMO about data, should we fear a hashtag?
Oh, that's data a good bubble? One.
Yeah.
Nice one, Russell. What does a data bubble even look like? Maybe we've already gone through it, right, with interest rates going up. I think we were in a data bubble. Absolutely. There was FOMO. I'm not quite sure there's FOMO anymore. I don't think people are admitting this as much. So I'd say we've gone through it, and here we are after the bubble bursting.
Yep.
Asking these questions.
Do you consider the AI bubble a continuation of the data bubble or something entirely new? I guess that would be my next question.
Oh, I think so. I'd say it's entirely new. I think data people are trying to glom onto it because, you know, AI does data, we do data, hang on, we should be in there. But I do think it's somewhat separate because ChatGPT being the Kickstarter has really had nothing to do with data or analytics people.
Not at all. Yeah, you're absolutely right on that. I think the VCs chased the money, right? Because they still had money they needed to deploy.
This is the thing. Yeah.
Yeah. And then everything went from like data into AI or data and Web3 and blockchain into AI.
Yep.
So basically I noticed that every like Web3 bro is now an AI person. Every data company now has some sort of AI angle to it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, every day I'm hit up by people like, hey, check out my new product. It's like, oh, this has an LM in it. Cool. Like all the 1,000 other companies that I've seen. That's awesome.
Where customer impact is sort of glossed over. You know what I mean? There is this, you know, God, I remember what was it, back in like 2012, 2013, even on machine learning was all the rage. You know, this is when the data scientist title was coming up in parallel. We had machine learning was all the rage. You went through then data analytics, you went through crypto, and now we're in AI. There's always hype cycles. It feels like out of every hype cycle, though, something useful comes out in the midst of all noise.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I use ChatGPT every day. It's awesome.
My sister works, you mentioned Excel. My sister works a finance job, was mentioning how she now uses it all the time for Excel formula.
Yeah.
And that's where she gets Excel formulas out of rather than sitting there working through the arcane documentation.
As one should, right?
Yeah.
It's pretty good.
Yeah, so on data bubble, it does feel like we're past it. You know, the bubble has burst for data.
Yeah.
We're going through an existential question of, well, where are we going?
Where do you think we're going?
God, I don't know, because again, the fundamentals still haven't been addressed, right? Yeah. It doesn't feel like we can get far without, you know, oh, this is one of these comments that, you know, it's like saying, oh, why can't society be better? Why can't people be nicer? I don't mean to sound naive and Pollyannish, but it does feel like addressing the fundamentals is a bit necessary for us to move forward. We've gone through all these fancy tools, and yet here we are acknowledging that perhaps we're at square one.
I think so. It almost feels like there's been a regression in knowledge. Like I said, I feel like if I ask data practitioners, especially the latest crop, okay, so you know, explain to me data modeling techniques, for example. I'm writing a book on this right now, and you just get blank stares. Like, oh, I make like a DBT model. That's what some people equate data modeling to be. You mentioned things like a star schema. It's like, well, that's stupid. Like, because joins, right? So one big table is what everyone's fascinated by. And like, that's great, except this also means like potentially a very incoherent data set. But who cares about that? You know, definitely avoid all the joins you want at the expense of having data that makes any sense.
So that's a very specific problem that still remains alive and well and kicking over the last 10 years plus, right? Data modeling and having good taste for it. We still have no magic wand there.
Nope.
We have anything close to a magic wand, and that the human being still needs to think about how do I model this universe to get impact out of it. It's the same with software engineering, interestingly. Data modeling, it does rule our world.
Oh, software engineering, I'd almost say, is far worse with data modeling, too. The impacts of this aren't just for data. This is also software, by the way.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, I find engineers are, they lack a lot of the big ideas that I saw, you know, software engineers having back in the day, too. I think just the explosion of tooling in general just meant like everybody sort of just
tooling and money, you know, the worst combination. Yeah, tons.
And I talked to VCs that were funding data companies back in the day, a lot of the big ones. And I remember one big VC who I won't name, but they're like, this will never end.
What will never end? Just funding?
Just the funding and the whole growth. This is in 2021.
Oh, goodness.
Right at the top. Right at the top. Yeah.
Yeah. And lo and behold. Do you feel there's a sense of, you know, I do wonder about data people being burnt out and so on. Joe, question for you on your comment. Do you think with age, do you worry that cynicism creeps up? We talk about data people, this and that, and this other thing.
I'm 47, so I'm pretty old at this point.
Well, you look rather young and sprightly, one has to say.
yeah, I'm a curmudgeon and deep down. So, sorry, my dog's barking. I think it happens. I also think you sort of get rejuvenated in some sense because you, at least for me, I feel like my mission now is it's not to build more systems. I think it's to help educate the next generation of people as well as the existing one. At least for me, that's my calling. I don't know about Matt, how he can explain himself in his curmudgeonness. But yeah, I feel like that's at least, you know, what I'm focused on right now is I feel like I can be cynical about stuff or I can help solve the problem.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I'm choosing to help solve it. What do you think, Matt? Does your old age get to you?
I mean, I've always been a curmudgeon to some extent. I think the challenge is that the world is changing so fast that it is very hard to assess what kinds of things you can teach the next generation of people getting into the field and what you can learn from them as well, right? Because we probably have all kinds of blind spots. Mm-hmm. Like we come to this new technology, be it the interwebs, you know, when I was already kind of an adult that was taking off, or AI. And I think the younger generation just grasps it fundamentally better than I do in some ways, right?
Oh, they
grow up with it. And then, but then the question is, from your perspective, Joe, I mean, you've been talking about this for a long time. Like, what is it that you would tell your younger self about software and tech that is both timely and timeless? Timely, really appropriate for the current moment of social change wrought by AI, and timeless that it will outlast the current moment somehow, or that it still applies, even though it's something you learned 20 years ago or something like that.
I don't know. That's a good question. I think understanding the contours of what AI is good at and what it's not good at, I think, is a good place to start. Intersecting that with what's going to make you happy, both life and career-wise, I think is a good place because, yeah, that's what I tell my kids. Like, find something that's AI probably isn't going to be as good at doing, and, you know, but find something that's going to make you happy, you know, but it could be any number of things, right? But yeah, kids these days, too, it's interesting because they're like, they understand AI and tech better than I think we all do. It's just it's intuitive to them, right? I mean, but every kid wants to be an influencer too. So there's that. There's all on YouTube.
Oh, the influencers. That was another zero. Was that a zero interest rate phenomenon? Joe, would you call yourself an influencer at any moment?
No, I don't. I mean, I know people that
never worn that label.
I don't call myself that. I mean,
okay.
I'm reluctantly one.
Is it a influencer someone who was shilling for a vendor and being paid by the vendor? Is that what an influencer is?
I think it's somebody who has a capability of doing that. Yeah. I've only done that a couple of times and I felt just dirty about it. I won't do it. I think I did a couple of things. I was like, I can't do sponsored posts. I can't like
you needed a good scrub in the shower after, you know, just to.
Yeah. It just is not for me, man. I did it and I was like, it's cool, but you know, a lot of friends do it, but I just can't. So
it does feel like data influencers spiked and went back down.
Well, that was definitely a zero interest rate thing for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. I feel like at least looking at my LinkedIn feed, you know, influencer content seems to have gone down.
But do we still see AI influencer content? I mean, I think the influencers just chase wherever the money is flowing from venture capital because those companies have money to spend to promote their products and they need to spend it somewhere.
Well, I know that some companies are paying influencers, you know, a few thousand dollars per post and they were getting like maybe one or two webinar registrations. I'm like, the cost per sign up is insane, right? Oh, so goodness. The numbers weren't making any. So for others, it certainly does, right? But I think it's like underlying it. If you don't have a product that people care about and you're trying to get influencers to shill it, at the end of the day, it's going to be ineffective. Mm. You know what I mean?
Yep.
So
makes sense. Going back to in the spirit of, maybe some more concrete things for the data people. Data modeling, again, just remains a topic I'm rather fascinated by because it remains such a human endeavor. It's still a human endeavor where one needs taste and thought and planning. And if you really get it right, the payoffs are so obviously bigger than if you get it wrong. Why do you think data modeling remains a challenge?
I'll ask Matt this. I've always wanted to know what Matt thinks about this.
This is indeed a question for the both of you.
Yeah.
So, I mean, from my perspective, there are several reasons. I think one of the problems that we run into is that the underlying motivation for data models in the era of transactional relational databases with limited memory, limited storage, that was some very particular constraints that we had to think about at the time. And that's where a lot of the mathematical normal forms came from. Suddenly you get into this new era and there were, in spite of the fact that the basics stayed the same, columnar databases, massive storage, like we suddenly had a lot less constraints on what we could do. And so it was very easy to just throw all your data into one big table or at least not structure it in any way.
Constraints, a few of them melted away. So you didn't have to think of the hard stuff. Yeah.
And then I think on top of that, we do need a new vision. In other words, yes, fundamentals are that you still need data models, but I think you need a new vision that takes into account that we're working in columnar systems. And I think it needs to be something beyond the old normal forms or star schema model, but also not just one big table. Like somewhere in between is a truth we're looking for, where it's you have to find the right hybrid of those approaches that uses the tools in the best way possible and also uses the human brain in the best way possible, where we're combining the best that can come out of those approaches. And so, Joe, that's what I'm hoping for from you, like new, completely new vision of how to model data in this world that we've kind of come of age in.
Thanks.
No problem.
It's something I'm working on. Yes. I think this is one of the cruxes, though. It has to be solved. That and architecture, I think, is the other one. Like that's, I think, very misunderstood. The modern data stack, I think, was a good example of an architecture that was very vendor-driven.
And oh, God. I mean, how could you possibly call something modern, right? Surely in 10 years, no one's going to be using the adjective modern. It's always a sort of a red alarm when someone does that.
But I think it did a paint-by-numbers job for architecture. Like, the architecture is just these technologies, and that's it. And it didn't take into account, like, okay, so what are the requirements? What are the trade-offs? What's the modularity? What's the decoupling? You know, all these things you want to take into account with architecture were sort of abandoned. It's like, I thought that was interesting. Architecture is the other one where I feel like that people don't understand it as much as they probably used to.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. In the realm of, practicalities for the listeners, Matt, going back to you with a question, how can someone become better at data modeling? Like, we spent time discussing just how fundamental this activity is. So surely people out there may ask, how can we get better?
I think one area where I completely agree with Joe is that even though the old techniques of normal forms and star schemas maybe shouldn't be rigidly adhered to all the time, you should still read the classics. Like, go study up on what was done in the past and use that as your starting point.
I agree.
Think that's,
Like Codd's original 1970 paper. about relational data modeling is still the classic. I think it was relational modeling on data banks, large data banks, which they used to call these systems. Now they're databases. Kimball's book, Bill Inman, all the giants, right? I mean,
the number of people who'd recognize these names today, I think, maybe is small, given the last 3-4 years. Yeah.
Bill's seeing a bit of a resurgence, though. I think Bill Inman, like he's cool with the cool kids again. So,
It's sort of the approach to English literature, if you will, right? Read the classics to develop taste.
And yet, having taught math for a long time, all of academia has a problem with being out of date, right? And so it's this compromise between reading the classics, but then also reading a lot of new approaches. And so you can figure out your own synthesis of those ways of doing things.
Is there anything out there that's sort of a sexy new approach with promise?
Sorry, Joe, what do you mean by that?
You know, when Matt talks about new approaches, right, to doing things, is there anything, you know, yes, Joe's working on his course. Is there anything out there that's caught the eyes of just some new approach to data modeling or a way of thinking about it?
That's a good question. I keep seeing, I think, articles popping up on different approaches, analytics, especially some variants of Data Vault, for example, or anchor modeling is another one. It's cool. Activity schema is one where I think it almost got there, but it didn't. So nothing that's caught the people's attention, though, right?
Yep.
Yeah. What's interesting is when you talk about education, up until our book came out, I think that the books that people would look at for data engineering was Ralph Kimball. That was like, but it's still the book for data engineering. I'm like, it's interesting. It teaches you the modeling technique, but that's one part of everything else.
Yep.
Right, or throwing you into designing data-intensive applications, which is a fantastic book, but
to be honest, most of it has nothing to do with analytics data people, really.
No, nothing at all, actually.
Really for software engineers maintaining.
I mean, the chapter on data modeling is more about binary trees, for example. It has nothing actually to do with data modeling. It's actually arguing with Martin Kleban about this, where he's like, "That's data modeling." I'm like, "No, not exactly how the world does it." From a from an implementation standpoint in databases, sure. But that's not an intentional way of modeling your business. And I don't know. Anyway,
it's the physical layer, right? It's still important. But to your point, Joe, you'll be talking a lot about the various layers of data modeling. And I think even taking the time to think about the different layers of data modeling is a good starting point, even if you're not going to do things exactly the way we used to do them.
Yeah, conceptual, logical, physical, right? Conceptual is a big one where I think that needs to come back. If you ask people what conceptual modeling is, you'll get blank stares. Right. I ask this all over the world. People are like, I have no idea what you're talking about. That's stupid. I'm just going to go make one big table in Snowflake. I think I called one big table WTF, like wide, tall, and full. Could have fun with it. But yeah, education's a big one, man. I think it's kind of how, you know, I think how we got kind of got into the zero interest bubble to begin with is like, it was tempting to make all these different products, which I could argue were mostly features, actually. There was so much money being thrown around right at a certain point. It's like, is that actually a company? You know, or not. But then there's a market for it. People don't know the difference. And
the question is the market big enough? That's really, ultimately,
that's a good question.
Companies that deserve VC money are ones that can potentially, even with the smallest likelihoods in the world, potentially hit a big return. And that's purely done through a market size exercise. Now, it could work. Yeah. There's a bunch of valid companies, but the markets aren't quite as big. Hence, perhaps, not quite deserving or needing VC money, but it just became so cheap. It was everyone's default path, I think.
Yeah.
That's a big one.
And my interpretation too is that you had several phenomena. You had zero interest rates. You had COVID. There was just a lot of money sloshing around in the economy at the time. And then you had the September IPO of Snowflake, September
2020. Oh, that was a big one too. Yeah.
That was huge. And so I feel like after that, everyone was like, okay, you know, the big data, the whole Hadoop thing didn't work out so well, but hey, this Snowflake thing is huge. How are we going to get on this bandwagon? Aside from investing in Snowflake itself, where are we going to like ride this wave of the next generation of data, especially while everyone is locked at home working, 16 hours a day on data processes? How can we get some of that money?
Oh, yeah. I know we felt stupid for not doing a data startup.
Oh, yeah. You felt FOMO, as they say.
Well, even Matt and I was like, I got all of our friends are raising crazy amounts of money and, rich on paper. I don't know.
There's a party going on, right? So you're wondering, well, why am I not there?
And here we are running our lowly consultancy, Yeah, it's kind of like a WTF moment for us too. We're like, okay, are we dumb?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Turns out with proper timing, I don't think we were actually. So yep. I have a hard time getting wedded to a particular product idea for many years too. It's like now I have to like really believe in this approach to the world.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, yeah, for
and that's
sure.
Hard. That's hard for me to do. I've been at startups before. And I'm like, I just like to pivot. And then content allows you a lot more freedom to do that, I think, versus a product that you have to focus on for and really hone. I guess I get bored real easy.
Yep. No, it makes sense. On that topic then, well, bit of a distant relationship really, but we covered data modeling, right? Still being essential for people to know how to do. It's still human judgment involved there. The other one being the topic of business impact, right? I'm a data leader,
big one,
right? A data manager, leader, again, another trite word, but you get the concept. And how can people get better at that one?
Ooh, that's a good one. I think it depends on the type of company.
There's such essential skills, right? And people have no idea how to, you know, they go, well, okay, I'm listening to this. This is great. I need this for my survival and fulfillment. Now what?
I think it depends on the type of company you're at. You know, I was talking about Sol Rashidi. You know, she's been a four-time C-suite exec in data. Mm. We're talking about enterprise versus tech companies. I don't think she'd ever work at an enterprise again. And she scared me away from wanting to ever be a C-suite working in data at an enterprise. There's so much political stuff and so much just shenanigans going on there. And it's like, for you to have an impact, you got to get buy-in from all these stakeholders. And this is you know, at the top level. You know, as an individual contributor, you're expected to deliver on this stuff, and hopefully you can. But it's hard. I think it's just hard for data to get traction, especially at big companies. It's very hit and miss. I don't know, Matt. You've thought a lot about business impact, I'm sure. You're writing a book at some point on it.
Here's my question. I think the first question I have is, do the B schools, in other words, the MBA programs, have actually a positive impact on the people who finish those programs? In other words, do they come out having a real concrete, better understanding of how to run a business than when they came in? I mean,
I'm going to deal with this question.
Yeah.
My concern is that I feel like, ideally, we would have an education system that could cross over and teach people analytic skills and also teach people how businesses actually work.
In the context of a business.
Yes, a real business, like not some abstraction, but like if I work for a factory and I'm doing analytics, what is the point? Like, how am I actually helping? And maybe try to study some of the best businesses out there, like Toyota. Like, how is Toyota getting these levels of quality, and how do they get their cars to stay on the road for 300,000 miles and not break down? Like, those are really fundamental questions. And I feel like right now, I do appreciate things like the MSBA programs, Masters of
Business Analytics.
Business Analytics, yeah. So there are these nice programs for training in business analytics and such, but we're not really like bridging that divide toward practical skills, toward understanding how businesses work and how analytics have an impact on that process. And so maybe part of this is an education discussion. I don't know.
But data is also highly political at companies.
Yeah, that's another one.
Right.
Yep.
I've always
useless or it's political, you know?
Well, so that's impact sort of an interesting one then, because it's like impact for whom?
Yeah, someone, right? Some decider person, right? Someone who anoints you as you are a useful person to this company.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which really, I mean, I know people look at companies as these abstract entities, Google decided X or Y, but really it's all people, right? Some boss decided something and everyone hopped to it. Some boss promoted people, some boss hired people, and so on. And I think data people, even at this primitive sort of monkey see, monkey do level, are trying to figure out where they can slot in. One thing I'd say, I do hesitate to give advice, but for those listening, my world is a B2B SaaS world for years. I think the business side of the office has been given short shrift, where data teams often reporting to engineering due to, again, the rise of the sexy data scientist and analytics engineer, right? You've got an engineer in your title, therefore you're reporting to engineering. They do tend to initially gravitate towards the product side of the house. But the product tools are actually pretty good, right? You have Amplitude and, you know, your mixed panel inheritors, if you will, that can spin up fine automatic dashboards based on user usage and all this stuff. I think the business side of the house has a lot more waiting for data people regarding impact, you know, your sales, your marketing, your operations, and so on. I suspect people gravitate towards product. They go in there, the product people don't really care about them in the end. The data person then concludes feeling despondent. No one cares. But product teams, of course, are incentivized to ship rather than measure. So at the root of everything, you have a problem there. But it feels like the business people dealing with a lot of messy data, things to help the sales team and marketing team, there's probably a lot more to be done there. Sounds boring though, but again, what's worthy work isn't, you know?
So, it's not boring though. I always felt like, and I wrote about this too, I feel like
it's not like
data people will be successful when they stop using the term data to describe.
I see.
Right. My first job I was working, I did marketing, I did sales, operations, running supply chain and stuff. And I don't think ever once did we call ourselves like the data people, right? I was always using data to fulfill a business need. And that's where I learned about the impact of data. And what it could really do, but I never said, oh, I'm going to do data stuff. I think I tried that once and people were like, can you just shut up and like just do something actually? Yeah. So
interesting. You think the self-declared data titles are actually limiting then?
I think so.
Now, you set these boundaries for yourself. It's inevitable that they'll result in dissatisfaction and despondency because you've set these boundaries for your work.
I think so.
Oh, that's a big one.
Yeah.
Do you know how many data teams are out there with these boundaries?
Oh, yeah. I think it's stupid. It's necessary in some companies, but yeah, I don't think it's necessary.
And we're so focused on being descriptive as opposed to proactive. Mm. Actually working with the business side that has authority to do things and saying, here's some data, but actually what can we do with the business with this data? Like how can we make our customer service better? How can we get a clearer vision of inventory? Because clearly we're having problems with inventory right now, or these kinds of questions. Like what are the things that keep the C-suite and the middle managers awake at night, and how can we actually solve those with data? And Joe, I think back to your experience, that was a lot of it, right? Like there were these very severe problems at the time, economic problems and such that your employers were facing, and you actually got the opportunity to take data and try to help them solve some of those problems.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Like being hired to do forecasting and the great financial crisis happens.
That sounds like a load of fun.
Yeah.
There's a party, it's probably that one.
Yeah. What's that?
If there's a party that I've ever heard of, it's probably that one.
Yeah, you try forecasting demand when demand drops off a cliff. You have no previous idea of what that looks like at all. You learn to be really good at your job. So.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, and you have to find new ways of looking at the business because like the old ways won't work. Demand planning simply does not work in that inflection point. Done.
Yeah.
Right.
So then updated teams and roles. Well, this word C-suite has popped up. Should there be such a thing as a chief data officer?
Ooh. This is a good one. Yeah, yeah.
What do you think,
what do you think, Joe? I mean...
I have an opinion too. I'll keep this until the end. Yeah. Well, I used to, of course, in my younger years when I had more hair on my head. Of course, I'm a fresh-faced data person. Of course, there should be a chief data officer everywhere. Now, I'm just not so sure. At least in the B2B SaaS world I live in, I wonder whether there'd be weird dynamics at the exec level when you have, like, the CFO is your classic neutral character. This person's already present there, neutrally reporting on the business. What does it mean to have another neutral character taking up a spot
in
the C-suite? Yeah. Right? Can those dynamics possibly be healthy?
Yeah, I've never held the position myself, so it's hard to say. I was at a CDO summit in the winter, and I felt like I was at an AA meeting.
What's the Can you say more? What sort of themes?
People were commiserating, like the business doesn't understand us. We spend all of our time trying to get alignment with the business. You know, people don't understand what we do. The tenure's short, right?
It's indeed short. Yep.
Yeah, it just feels like everything about it was just, I would never want the job ever. And now all these people are pivoting to being chief AI officer because that's, you know, the cooler job now versus data.
Mm.
Right, but same thing. It feels like it's just a C-suite position that is...
It's meaningless in some sense compared to like your head of sales who has to deliver concrete things.
Yeah. I think at some companies it could work for sure, depending on the maturity of the company with data. But I think if just trying to hire a CDO and expecting magical things to happen, I think is a huge, huge mistake. Like I said, I'd love Sol's opinion on this, but I don't know. Matt, what do you think?
Well, I mean, I think let's go kind of old school and look at what's happened with IT itself. So having a CTO or CIO in practice sort of, it sort of has partitioned all of information technology to be separate from the rest of the company. And that is actually a really bad thing, I would argue, because the technical org, the IT org in a lot of companies is treated like the nerds in the basement. Like, oh, we have to feed the nerds pizza once in a while, and we have to pay for, you know, SAP or whatever Microsoft product to keep this company running. And that separation sort of sucks the possibility for innovation out of the company, because they're not very integrated or embedded with the rest of the company to say, hey, if we had this better application with a better customer service experience, how would it impact our business? I just don't think there's enough of that, because it is so segregated away from the rest of the business. And I feel like sometimes when you have a CDO position, if they're not, if it becomes uncollaborative with the other parts of the C-suite, then the impact might be pretty negative, because the CDO sort of runs all the data stuff and it gets separated out.
Mm-hmm. I think it becomes a bit weird then, right? Because then you also have this person whose org isn't really responsible for delivering anything that matters to the business on a first degree, right? It's sort of second degree removed reporting. And this just gives me pause. You know, I just do wonder, perhaps we could use fewer CDOs, not to sound too, again, despondent for any CDOs out there.
Yeah, you're all doing a great job out there.
Just keep at it, and maybe just, you know, skip this bit. But again, I just do wonder, right? There's a few people placing these positions, and I'm just really not surprised that Joe, your visit sounded like an AA meeting, because I think that's a natural human reaction.
Oh yeah, yeah. Everyone felt misunderstood, mm-hmm. underutilized.
Yep, and that probably again an indicator that this position maybe just should not exist. You know, sort of. Maybe go lower on the totem pole and serve other teams or work closely with them rather than being some head person at that level.
Well, and if this is the pinnacle of what you can do as a data person, that's pretty scary, right?
This is the thing, right? I mean, this goes back to the angst amongst data people of where am I going?
Your tenure is what, 18 months, 2 years on average?
And what do you have to say for yourself regarding accomplishments, right, in those 2 years? I bet that's a question too.
Yeah. Like, I got older.
The default accomplishment.
And feel older, right? Mm. I mean, that's a tough one.
Maybe something similar with design, right? UX design, when you have a chief design officer, right? This person, again, they're not a VP of engineering responsible for delivering product. They're also a VP of marketing responsible for delivering sales leads and so on. I suspect similar feelings of angst go up there.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, Where are we left with then regarding an optimistic message for all the data people out there?
Do your best.
Data is not going away. I think that's not.
It's growing.
I think Matt's point is an extremely crucial one to cling on to. Data is just, despite all this, it remains ever present. It's only ever going up in volume. Well, it's not the new oil, it's the old oil. Well, it shall remain so with time. The problems aren't going away. It may be that where we land on is we just need different solutions or new solutions.
I think you're right. Different ways of looking
at our approach.
Our
approach maybe could stand to use a bit of difference. An approach is needed. That's not going away because of the presence of data, as Matt said.
I think that's actually
quite an optimistic note to end on, right?
It is.
Well,
you'll be back for the next episode on this then.
So if you're a data person out there and you'd like to embrace a novel approach, you'll be needed.
Oh, yeah. I'm curious to see where AI takes that, too. We're at a very fascinating spot in history right now.
Yeah, when we talk about business impact, right? And maybe AI just makes that bit easier, too.
Hope so.
The all-seeing eye can look at more and help us find business impact. Fingers crossed.
It's been good chatting with you. I need to have you back on the show. I made a note.
I've lost quite a few hairs on my head over the years thinking about all these things and being placed in some of these situations. I think it's a very interesting field as a result. The answers just aren't clear. And that's another optimistic message I take away.
Right.
Yeah. And I think if data people can learn to work with business people, people who sign the checks and make the decisions, there's a very, very bright future for them if they can learn to move into some of those business roles and use data in their jobs. Mm-hmm. We were arguing about this term, data-driven, in Spain when we were at the conference. But really, I mean, I think for me, data-driven can mean a lot of different things, but the point is data is useful, and if you can develop business skills and use it appropriately, then you have a bright future.
Well, Caleb, thanks for being on the show, man. Very thoughtful conversation. Yeah. I like the, like the flow of this. We'll definitely have you back on.
Well, I hope it wasn't too meandering and random, but...
That's
really where data is.
No more than it already is with Matt and me, so it's good. you're one of us. It's good.
No, it's a pleasure and an honor to be hosted, that's for sure.
Of course. Anything you want to give a shout-out for, Polytomic or anything else?
Yes, Polytomic, we are a tool that does ETL in all directions, and so you could simply buy us rather than buying multiple products in your so-called data stack. We'll just take care of moving data everywhere.
Super cool. Polytomic. Matt, anything you have coming up?
Let's see. There's Generative AI Application Summit in Phoenix, Arizona in about a month in June. So go check that out. I'll be there.
I'll be in London next week, later this weekend, actually. But next week, a bunch of stuff going on there. So hit me up. And then I guess I'm going to be at Snowflake Summit, but not at the event, but at some parties. So Mother Duck, and then Ethan Aaron's happy hour. So I'll have a beer.
I'll probably be at the Mother Duck party as well.
Yeah, we'll see you there. That'd be dope. We're going to carry on the conversation, man. But,
for sure.
Fun, yeah. And I'm taking some time off after that. I think the summer off.
No doubt.
Yeah, needs to happen. So awesome. Well, next week we have Rob Harmon on. Speaking of awesome people with strong opinions. So looking forward to that. And thanks everybody for the showing up, and we'll see you next week.
Thanks, later, everyone.
Bye. See ya. Cool. I have to jump to